whoever had just arrived was talking to the night clerk. Was this the replacement clerk? If so, Ricky should be able to get out of there without anyone being the wiser as soon as things settled down again. But the new person did not stay in the reception area for long. The footsteps headed Ricky's way for a moment before stopping. Ricky heard another door open and the person step inside. He crept over the wall to the manager's office, shared with the HR room, and placed his ear against it. The musical tone of a computer turning on confirmed the person had entered the neighboring office. Knowing this might be his best opportunity to get out of there unseen, Ricky snuck into the hallway, peeked into the HR office, and then scampered past when he saw that the woman sitting at the desk had her back to him. Moments later, he was once more in the public area. He spent the next 30 minutes correlating the locations of the kids' and chaperones' rooms with those of other guests on his list. Interestingly, the room for one of the solo travelers was right next door to the one Andrew Carter had used. The hotel had been half empty at the time, so it couldn't have been a coincidence. God, if Ricky could just make one phone call and have someone look into the names, he knew he'd break this thing wide open before Ananka and the others had even had breakfast. His stomach growled. Breakfast, now there's an idea. It turned out the lodge restaurant didn't start serving until 6 a.m., which meant Ricky had to wait, which made him cranky, which meant when the restaurant did open, the Denver omelet he ordered didn't arrive at his table until 6:17. One look at it was all he needed to send it back. When the waiter returned with it 6 minutes later, the thing on the plate looked no better than it had before. Clearly, the cook was unfamiliar with how to create a good Denver omelet. Ricky, if he did say so himself, was an expert.
Maybe there's something else on the menu you might enjoy more,
the waitress suggested after Ricky communicated his dissatisfaction. There's nothing I would enjoy more than a Denver omelet. It is what I've been thinking about for the last hour. It is what I came in here to eat. It is what I want. He picked up the corner of the plate and let it drop back on the table with a bang. This, however, is not a Denver omelet. The woman smiled uncomfortably.
I'm sorry, but I don't know what else I can do.
I think the best thing would be for me to talk to your cook.
Oh, I don't think that's a good idea. The chef is very busy right-
Chef? Ricky snickered. Ma'am, the person in your kitchen is not a chef. He's a cook, and not a very good one.
Ricky rose.
Trust me, he'll appreciate my feedback.
Wait, you can't go in there!
But Ricky wasn't listening to her anymore. He pushed through the swinging door into the kitchen and stopped a few feet inside. Who's the one pretending to be in charge in here? It took two dishwashers, three prep cooks, a security guard, apparently they had one during the day, and the largest of the waitresses to pull Ricky from the man who claimed to be a chef and restrain Ricky until the sheriff's deputies arrived. Ricky, of course, loudly proclaimed his innocence as he was ushered to the deputy's car in handcuffs, saying he'd only been trying to help someone who obviously didn't know what he was doing. The deputies, for their part, smiled and nodded and told him to watch his head as they helped him into the back seat. 24. After following the deputy's car all the way back to a small sheriff's substation in Groveland, Ananka, Dylan, and Liesl watched the deputies transfer Ricky inside. Ananka didn't think there was a moment during the whole parade when Ricky's lips weren't moving.
Do we go in and get him out?
Dylan asked. They're not going to just hand him over, so unless you'd like to get into a firefight over that asshole, then no, we don't go in. As tempted as Ananka was to let Ricky stay locked up, if the sheriff's department figured out he'd been staying at the Hardwick Inn, they'd quickly learn he hadn't been there alone. That would be a major problem. Like it or not, she had to do something.
Progress? The administrator asked when she had him on the line.
We have a situation.
Is that so?
She filled him in.
And you don't know the reason he was arrested?
He asked when she finished.
I can think of several hundred, but I don't know specifically.
He said nothing for a moment. Then,
I would like you to return to the hotel until you hear from me again. We're not going to get a lot done sitting in our rooms. Until I have a better idea of what's going on, it would be prudent if you stay out of sight. I promise you'll be hearing from me very soon. Upon returning to the Hardwick Inn, Ananka took 15 minutes to freshen up before meeting up with the others in Rosario's room.
Anything new? She asked Rosario. One of our chaperones may be involved with the kidnappers.
Oh, really? Do tell.
The chaperones were all supposed to have come from local 0.5 chapters, two from Palo Alto and one from Daly City, same chapters the kids are from. Marta Sorensen, the Daly City rep, needed to be replaced at the last minute.
Why? Ananka asked.
Single vehicle car accident, 2 days before the trip.
Drinking?
No alcohol or drugs in her system. The police report says several witnesses saw her car suddenly speed up and clip the side of a semi-truck, then flip over. She is still unconscious, so they have not been able to question her.
Suicide attempt?
Possible, but she had no apparent money troubles. Also, she is recently married, and everything I have found indicates they had no problems. Her medical records also contain no mentions of mental health issues. My guess is no.
You got into her medical records?
Shinji did.
Ananka grinned. I told you he'd be a help.
So far, he is acceptable.
Which one's the last-minute replacement?
Him. Andrew Carter. He was presented as a 0.5 member from San Francisco, able to fill in. A check of the San Francisco membership roll did turn up his name, but it appears that someone hacked their system and added Mr. Carter within the last week. Shinji checked the associated home address and employment information, but they were also false.
Ananka thought for a moment. Shinji has a facial recognition system that can check a whole crap load of databases. Have him run the picture of Carter we already in progress. Oh, great. I'm guessing no hits?
Nothing yet.
Ananka's mission phone began ringing. It was the administrator. Yes, she answered. You are free to continue your investigation. Ricky? Taken care of. In what way? The administrator, as he often did, hung up without answering. What happened? Dylan asked as Ananka lowered the phone. No idea. He just said it's taken care of. Don't you assassins say something like that when you kill someone? If only we were so lucky, Ananka thought. We need to get back out there. 5 minutes to freshen up, then meet back at the van? Works for me, Dylan said.
Liesl nodded.
Ananka walked to the door and opened it. As she stepped into the hallway,
Morning, kitten!
Ricky stood in front of the door to her room, his hand in mid-knock.
I was wondering where you were.
She jammed her finger against her lips and motioned for him to come to her. As soon as he was in range, she grabbed him by the front of his shirt, pulled him into Rosario's room, and pushed him onto the bed.
Whoa, baby, what was that for?
How about we start with you getting arrested? Ricky grinned sheepishly.
So, you heard about that, huh? Big guy tell on me?
We're the ones who told him, you idiot, right after we watched you get marched out of the Conifer Lodge and into that patrol car and taken to jail.
I was wondering how he found out so fast. That makes a lot more sense now. What the hell happened? She asked. There's a conspiracy in this country to keep people from knowing how to make a proper Denver omelet.
She closed her eyes in dread.
You didn't. Of course I did. Someone had to tell that cook what to do.
You were arrested over food?
Rosario said. She considered that for a moment before adding,
I hate to say this, but I can actually appreciate that.
Don't encourage him, Ananka said.
Sorry,
Rosario said, but gave Ricky a nod. Ricky acknowledged her with a point of his finger and then said,
So, what are you all doing here? You can't get anything done this way.
If there was ever a moment when Ananka wished she could breathe fire, this was it. She settled instead for drilling holes in Ricky's forehead with her gaze. It wasn't nearly as satisfying.
You're cute when you're angry, baby.
He glanced at Dylan.
I'm right, aren't I?
Dylan, looking uncomfortable, didn't respond.
You know what? Ananka said. I don't care why you were arrested.
We need to get back out there and see if we can locate those motorcycles. I have a feeling they might...
Motorcycles? Ricky asked.
She brought him up to speed on what he'd missed while he was locked away. He grinned.
I've seen your motorcycles.
Ananka stared at him.
Today? Where?
Not live, a recording.
Ricky told him about his visit to the manager's office at the Conifer Lodge and what he'd seen on the security footage.
Rosario showed him the clip of the biker Shinji had found.
Yep, same guys, Ricky said.
You're sure?
Sure, I'm sure.
That's actually helpful, Ananka said.
If you like that, you're gonna love this, he said.
What?
That chaperone you were talking about?
Carter.
He signaled the motorcycles before the van left.
You saw this? Liesl asked.
I sure did.
Ananka couldn't help but sound impressed when she asked, You find out anything else while you were digging around?
As a matter of fact...
Ricky showed them the photo of a list of other guests who'd been staying at the lodge over the same days the kids had been there, and tapped the name of the guy who'd been in the room next door to Carter's.
You were right, Dylan said to Ananka. He is a pretty damn good hunter.
Looking flattered and surprised, Ricky said,
Did you really say that about me, kitten?
Ananka looked at Rosario. Have Shinji check the names out. With a nod, Rosario motioned for Ricky to give her his phone.
We know there's no sign of the van leaving the area, Ananka said to everyone.
Same with the motorcycles, but they would have been easier to smuggle out in a camper or truck. If we can find one of them, it could help us figure out who these people are. Maybe even point us to where they've taken the kids. She had Rosario bring up a map of the area.
We'll need all our eyes on this, so that means you too, Ananka told her.
Shinji can handle research for now.
Rosario nodded. We'll split into two groups. My group will check places along these two roads.
Ananka pointed at two routes leading south from the highway.
Ricky, you'll check this one.
She pointed at the only road leading north.
Whatever you want me to do, kitten.
Oh, sorry. Jaw tensing, she said. Dylan, you'll be my driver. She looked at Rosario and Liesl.
I hate to do this, but one of you is going to have to go with him.
She nodded at Ricky. The women shared a look, then Liesl shrugged.
I will do it.
He is entertaining.
I am entertaining, aren't I? Ricky said.
Ananka rolled her eyes and said to Liesl, If he becomes a problem, feel free to dump him at the side of the road, or kill him, your choice.
25. The Bunker. The hatch opened, spilling ultra-bright light into the dark and dank space. Hands immediately went to eyes as those inside were blinded by the illumination. Two thuds on the floor, and then the hatch closed again, plunging the occupants once more into pitch black. A few muffled whimpers broke out, but no wailing like there'd been during the first few hours. A shuffling of feet, followed by the sound of plastic ripping.
Water, Erica Wright, one of the chaperones, said. Everyone, come to my voice.
The children and Chris Jones, the other remaining chaperone, started toward her.
Slowly, she said, there's plenty for everyone.
Ow! Nicholas shouted. Hey, there's something else here.
Cardboard ripped.
Feels like candy bars.
Let me check that,
Jones said. Sounds of movement and a wrapper tearing.
Granola bars,
Jones announced.
One each for now, Wright said. If there are extras, we'll divide them up later. Mr. Jones, make sure.
I know,
Jones said. Not for the first time, Wright wondered how long it would be before Jones snapped. The man had been going downhill since they were forced into this room. But with Carter gone and likely dead, both Wright and Jones needed to stay strong for the kids. There was no other choice.
26. Just west of Yosemite National Park. Ananka scanned the house through her binoculars. Though it was not deserted, it looked as if no one had been around for a while. A vacation home, likely. One with a very large 3-car garage in the back that had caught Ananka's interest.
She swung the glasses across the rest of the property. A dull forest green Honda Element sat to the side of the circular driveway. Based on the dust and pine needles covering it, the vehicle hadn't moved in a while, probably months. She lowered her binoculars and whispered to Rosario, "We'll circle around and meet behind the garage." They headed off in opposite directions, Ananka alternating her gaze between the path before her and the property. Still no signs of recent activity. If not for the garage, she and Rosario would be back in the van, headed to the next destination. But it was the biggest they'd seen so far, and could easily hide a van and several motorcycles. She turned on her mic.
"Anything?"
"Nothing so far," Rosario said.
"Dylan?" He was still in the van, keeping an eye out in case someone came up the access road.
"Nice and quiet, boss."
Ananka continued around the property until she was in the woods behind the garage. A few moments later, Rosario joined her. She'd been hoping the building had a window along the back, but other than several vents near the roofline, the wall facing them was unbroken. She motioned for Rosario to stay where she was, and then Ananka headed toward the garage. As she stepped out of the trees, her toe caught on a twig, causing her to glance down. Only it was not a twig, but a monofilament tripwire strung low through the brush. Before she could free her toe, one end of the line snapped.
"Down!"
she yelled. The building was more storage shed than garage, but Ricky figured a van might fit as long as there wasn't anything else inside. So he picked the lock and pulled the rusty hinge door open.
"Nope," he said to Liesl, standing off to the side. "I'm thinking this van isn't worth the time it's taking."
This was the sixth place they'd checked without finding anything.
"It might contain fingerprints or something that could identify the kidnappers. If we know who they are, it will be easier to find them."
"Might contain," he said, as they started walking back toward the car. "There's your key word. But who'd be stupid enough to leave a van full of evidence?"
"But what if they did?"
He glanced at her.
"You're like a piranha, aren't you? You grab onto something and don't let go."
She walked on as if she hadn't heard him. After the comment she'd made when she agreed to go with him, he thought they would get along just fine, but man, did she turn out to be a tough nut to crack. She wore an all-business, tough-as-nails attitude like a second skin. Pretty, too, though he doubted she realized it, or if she did, cared.
"Anybody ever tell you you've got nice eyes?" he said without thinking.
She turned on him, those same beautiful eyes narrowing to slits.
"You are not my type."
"Hey, I wasn't flirting, I was just, you know, stating a fact, and was curious if anyone else ever told you."
For a moment, he was sure she was going to hit him, but after a long pause, what she did was whisper,
"They smile."
"I'm sorry?"
"Someone once told me my eyes smile, a long time ago."
He was right. "That's it exactly. He an old boyfriend?"
Another pause, then,
"An almost boyfriend."
That kind of comment called for further prodding, but when he opened his mouth to do that, a loud rumble rolled over the trees. Ananka flew into the woods on the concussive wave of the explosion. For a moment, she lay on the forest floor, stunned, with her ears ringing and no idea what had happened. Then she remembered the tripwire and,
"Rosario!"
Though she knew she had yelled, she couldn't hear herself. She struggled to her feet and turned in a circle.
"Rosario!"
A wall of flames filled the space where the garage had been, while burning debris that had been blasted into the air was raining down in a fountain of fire.
"Rosario!"
Something touched her arm. She whirled around to find Rosario standing there, blood dripping from a cut on her forehead. Rosario's lips moved, but all Ananka could hear was the buzzing echo of the explosion. She pointed at her ears and shook her head, then motioned back toward the van. They ran through the trees, dodging pieces of the garage still falling from the sky and spots of fire that had already caught on the ground. When they emerged onto the driveway, Dylan was out of the van looking toward the blaze. He ran to them, his mouth moving a mile a second. Ananka waved him off.
"No, get the van started!"
He skidded to a stop and reversed course. Ananka and Rosario reached the van as the engine roared to life, a noise Ananka was relieved to find she could actually hear. She let Rosario in first and flopped into the bench seat beside her.
"Get us out of here!"
she yelled at Dylan as she slid the side door shut. He jammed the accelerator to the floor. Looking out the back window, Ananka could see flames licking into the air from the tops of several trees. The house, too, was starting to burn. She pulled her phone out of her pocket. The screen was shattered, but she pushed the activate button anyway. Nothing happened. She grabbed the disposable cell she'd bought to contact Shinji. Thankfully, it had survived her airborne flight through the woods. She punched in 911, but could barely hear the ring. When she thought she heard the operator's voice, she said, "There's been an explosion!" She gave the location as best she could and added, "The fire's spreading into the trees! Hurry!" She hung up, removed the phone's battery and SIM card, snapping the latter in two, and tossed the pieces out the window. Littering was not something she did lightly, but it was a small crime compared to the forest fire she'd inadvertently started, and reducing the chance of being caught due to a traceable SIM card seemed prudent. "Take us back to the hotel," she said. "We have to get out of here before they start evacuating everyone."
"Evacuating?" Dylan said, his voice muffled but now understandable. "Do you really think they'll do that?
There aren't a lot of ways in and out of the area. Unless they get that fire under control quickly, the authorities won't want anyone around. And when they start forcing people out, the roads are going to jam up."
"But what about the kids? What if they're in the area?"
"They're not."
"How do you know that?"
"Because if they were, then they were killed the day they were taken. Whoever set that trap knew what the explosion would do, so they wouldn't be keeping their prized bargaining chips anywhere near it. Can you make this thing go any faster?"
Dylan punched the accelerator.
"What about Liesl and Ricky?"
Rosario said. "Right," Ananka said. "I'm out of phones. Can you call them?"
"An earthquake?" Liesl asked.
They had stopped 30 feet shy of the Silverado and were looking in the direction from where the sound had come.
"You don't hear an earthquake without feeling it, too," he said. "I didn't feel anything, did you?"
Liesl shook her head.
"I don't like this. Come on."
They jumped into the truck, and Ricky started the engine. Instead of dropping it into gear right away, he called Ananka. The line rang several times before transferring to a mailbox that has not been activated at this time. He called again, same result.
"Do you know anyone's number besides Ananka's?" he asked.
"I have everyone's number."
"Why the hell didn't I get everyone's number?"
"Maybe so you wouldn't bother us?"
"Funny. Can you just try someone else, please?"
Liesl made a call, but after several seconds said,
"Rosario's not answering."
"We should go back to the hotel."
Ricky shifted the truck into drive.
"I agree."
They were almost back to Groveland when Liesl's phone rang.
"It's Rosario," she said.
Ricky tried to get the gist of the conversation, but for the most part, Liesl only listened.
When she hung up, she said,
"They are going to the hotel also."
"So they heard the explosion too?"
"Ananka set it off."
He slammed on the brakes and turned to her. "Is she all right?"
"She is okay. They are all okay. Now can we keep going, please?"
27. Word of the fire had apparently not reached the people in Groveland yet. The town was operating as normal. Campers filling their tanks with gas, cafe patrons eating an early lunch, and tourists walking in and out of the stores. The fire station also seemed quiet. Had it not gotten word, Ananka wondered? What if the phone had been damaged after all and the operator hadn't been able to hear her? Or maybe her disposable phone had sent her to a 911 call center not in the area. She was pretty sure there were safeguards against that, but she wasn't positive. "Rosario, I need your—" Lights on the fire station's front wall began flashing and the doors rolled open. Inside, more lights on the truck spun beams of red while sirens blared.
"Never mind," she said.
Ananka hated fire, hated its unpredictability, and most of all, the idea of dying in one. She would rather be tortured to death than barbecued alive. As they pulled into the hotel parking lot, Ananka spotted Ricky and Liesl waiting by Ricky's truck. There were other people outside, too, guests and several employees of the hotel, all looking east.
"Didn't your parents tell you not to play with matches?" Ricky asked as Ananka climbed out of the van.
She barely heard him, as her attention was on the dark column of smoke rising above the forest.
"We've got to get out of here before the traffic backs up," she said.
Everyone, grab your things and let's go. You have 2 minutes.
They sprinted into the building and were back at the vehicles before the deadline. When they pulled out of the lot, other guests, seeing that Ananka and her companions were fleeing, began running toward their own rooms.
Go, go, go,
Ananka told Dylan as he turned onto the highway. They'd made it a few miles west of Groveland when Rosario's phone rang. She answered it and glanced at Ananka.
She is?
Another pause.
Okay, sure. Rosario held the phone out. It's the administrator.
Ananka put the cell to her ear.
Yes?
Your phone is off. Permanently, I'm afraid. What happened? I landed on it a little too hard after I was thrown into the trees by an explosion. Explosion? The fire? Oh, you know about that, do you? Details, please. She updated him on her fun-filled morning. You couldn't have avoided the tripwire? He said when she finished.
Are you kidding me with that question? Look, if you want to play could have, should have, you can hire someone else.
My apologies. I'm sure you did all you could.
Gee, thanks.
Your explosion has changed the situation, however. I'd say the forest is on fire.
Yes, that too. What I meant is, the kidnappers have made contact again.
Ananka paused.
Why?
They have moved the deadline up to 8 a.m. tomorrow.
8 a.m.? Tomorrow? That's only 20 hours.
A little under.
How did they deliver the message? Text again?
Emails, but to the same three families.
When was it sent?
4 minutes after you triggered the bomb.
4 minutes? That can't be a coincidence.
No, it can't.
Can you forward the emails to Rosario?
Already done.
Ananka finished the call and told the others about the change in deadline. Rosario connected her laptop to her phone and used the cell signal to log on to her email.
Got them, she said.
She clicked a couple of times, spent several moments reading, and then handed the computer to Ananka. The recipient's information was at the top, followed by the sender's email address. Not a name, only a string of seemingly random numbers and letters from one of those free email services.
Subject: Your daughter. Hannah and her friends will die tomorrow at 8 a.m. The only way to prevent this is to transfer $20 million split evenly into the following five accounts. Below this was a list of account numbers, bank names, and routing numbers, all located outside the states in territories with lax customer identification laws. If the money is not received by 7:59 a.m., then you will be sent a follow-up email with directions on where to find your daughter's body. They compared the other two most recent emails to the first one. Three words had been changed in order to reflect the name and gender of the child.
I'll send these to Shinji, Rosario said. He can try to trace the send and also look into the bank accounts while we're on the move.
As Ananka settled back in her seat, she spotted two fire trucks about a mile away, lights spinning. When they drew near, Dylan pulled to the side, waited until they passed, then sped up again.
Where are we? She asked.
Just beyond some place called the Moccasin Reservoir.
I don't want to go too far until we decide where to go next. I think we'll be okay now, traffic-wise, so stop at the first good place you see.
He nodded. The first good place turned out to be the parking lot of a mini-mart in a town called Chinese Camp. Ricky pulled his truck in beside them. While everyone else went inside to grab something to drink and use the toilet, Ananka stayed in the van and studied the Google map of the area. By the time the others returned and piled into the van, the westbound traffic on the highway had begun to increase.
We shouldn't stay here too much longer, Ricky said. That traffic's going to be bumper to bumper before we know it.
You see that? Ananka pointed at a fork in the highway a few hundred feet to the northwest. One way takes us back into the mountains, and the other toward Modesto.
I don't know which way we need to go yet.
Have you forgotten about your little kaboom, baby? It seems to me that back into that mountains is the last place we should head.
Ananka held up a finger an inch from his nose.
This is the last time I tell you. I am not your baby. I am not your kitty cat. I am not your kitten.
My name is Ananka, and I am your boss. The next time you say anything even remotely condescending to me or to anyone else on the team, hell, to anyone else, period, I will have you tied up and inform the administrator that you've decided to go back to prison. Have I made myself clear? I'm a kind-hearted man. You're taking this all the wrong way, baby. So be it, she said, pulling out her phone. Wait, wait, what did I do? You said baby. Did I? She started dialing. Hold on, he said. You don't need to do that. I get it. No more sweet stuff. It's a stab to my soul, but I'll do it. She glared at him for a moment longer before putting her phone back in her pocket. All five of Shinji's computer stations were working overtime. He'd even had to co-opt some processing power from the computer science department at Cal State Los Angeles. Not that the school was aware of the intrusion, of course. Two of his machines were dedicated to track down as much information as possible about the five bank account numbers the kidnappers were using. Two others were processing camera footage from all sides of Yosemite. The last he was using to analyze the metadata attached to the ransom emails. Since they were all sent through an internet email service, the IP address associated with the sender was one owned by the service, not the actual computer the sender had used. For most people, that would have been as far as they could track things, but not for Shinji. Email services, such as the one in this case, logged the computer IP address of the sender for their records, even though they didn't include it in the metadata. Most people didn't know that. They only knew an email sent from such a place would appear anonymous. That's why those services were so popular for illegal activities. Hacking into the email system required exactly 2 minutes and 17 seconds. Since Shinji knew the exact moments the emails had gone out, he was able to locate them in a flash.
Good, he muttered.
The sending IP addresses were identical for all three emails. Not particularly surprising, but definitely reassuring. He entered the number into an IP locator website and was presented with the following results. Country, United States. Region, Nevada. City, Tonopah. With this came latitude and longitude coordinates. He input these into Google Maps and hit return. The satellite image zoomed in on the town of Tonopah, stopping directly on top of a building labeled Star Traveler Motel. While he thought it possible the kids were being held at a motel, he didn't think it highly likely. Still, it wasn't a dead end. Shinji absently grabbed his can of Diet Mountain Dew and had it halfway to his mouth before he realized it was empty. He tossed it into the nearly full recycle bin, snatched another from the mini fridge under his desk, popped it open, and took a gulp. He then set loose his considerable talents on the motel's computer system. As soon as he was through the firewall, he verified that the IP address belonged to one of the computers in the business center and then hunted down the security system. As he had hoped, there was a camera inside the center, no doubt to deter anyone from stealing the equipment. He located the footage from around the time the ransom emails had been sent and let it play. Sure enough, a man was sitting at the appropriate computer at the correct time. His features were hidden by the UNLV hoodie pulled over his head. That would have been disappointing if not for the fact that when he rose, he turned directly toward the camera for a solid 3 seconds, allowing Shinji to capture a clean image of his face. Shinji used other motel cameras to track the man's movement through the building and into the parking lot, where he climbed into a white Nissan Altima and drove off. The car was too far away from the camera to get a full look at the license plate, but Shinji could make out three of the characters. Those and the make and model of the car should be enough to find a match. The discovery was too good to simply email Rosario, so he reached for his phone. As he did, one of his computers dinged. He rolled his chair over and saw he'd received 3 hits on the Yosemite video footage. He brought up the clips and watched them. When he finished the last, he grabbed his phone again. Boy, did he need to call the others now. 28. The Bunker. Tessa Herrera stood in the center of the prison, directly below the hatch. She was scared, but not as scared as she'd been that first day when the armed motorcyclists had forced the van down a dirt road and then made Tessa and the others transfer into the back of a waiting RV. Her fear had hit its peak
when, after they'd been driving for over an hour, the RV pulled to the side of the road and one of their chaperones, Mr. Carter, had been dragged outside. Everyone heard their captor shouting at him, enraged because he hadn't stopped asking questions since being taken hostage. Mr. Carter pleaded for them not to hurt him and said he was sorry and that he'd shut up. For a few seconds, there was silence, and Tessa thought maybe they were bringing him back in. The bang that rang out next was so loud they all jumped.
"Oh, God," Connor had whispered.
Not having grown up in the best of neighborhoods, Tessa knew a gunshot when she heard one. Moments later, they were driving again, only without Mr. Carter in the vehicle. When the RV next stopped, the students and their two remaining chaperones were blindfolded and led to a ladder they were told to climb down. When they were finally given permission to remove the covering from their eyes, they had just enough time to see they were in some kind of long room with curved walls before the hatch above was shut and the space was plunged into complete darkness. There they had been ever since. Tessa had seen enough movies and TV shows to know the kidnappers were interested in a ransom. Why else would they have taken her and the others and stored them away? They wouldn't be looking for money for her, of course. Her mom was a bookkeeper for the owner of a small dry cleaning chain and wouldn't have anywhere close to the kind of money the kidnappers would want. And her dad? Well, her mom always said nice things about him, but Tessa had never met him. The same lack of family fortune went for Renata and Mark. No, the kidnappers were most likely only interested in getting money out of Grace's and Hannah's and Nicholas's families. They were the rich ones. Crazy rich, if Nicholas's bragging was true, and she was pretty sure it was. She, Renata, and Mark happened to be in the wrong place at the wrong time and had no real value to the kidnappers. That troubled Tessa. That was why she was standing under the hatch. It was the only spot she'd found where she could hear anything from above. Her hope was to overhear some of the kidnappers' plan and use the knowledge to somehow escape. She knew it was a long shot, but her only other choice was to sit around and wait for whatever was going to happen. So far, she hadn't learned much. Her biggest discovery had come a few hours earlier when she heard two of the captors called by name, Peterson and Nyland. In the time since, she had heard nothing, but now she was picking up voices again, male like all the other times. They were too far from the hatch for her to pick up anything except their tone at first. But as they moved closer, words started coming through. Slow and driver and can't and time. Tessa tilted her head so that her right ear was pointed directly at the hatch.
Later, or could.
I don't. But if we.
We need down right now.
Tessa straightened up as she thought the hatch was about to open. More talking, even closer now. I'll just... It's over.
You and me both. How long to... Do you think?
Cool it, asshole. You'll... Like the rest.
Sorry. Guess I'm a little...
Tessa's eyes grew wide. That voice. The last one. The man who'd apologized. Mr. Carter. He wasn't dead. In fact, he seemed to be talking with the kidnappers like he was one of them. As this thought hit her, other things began flashing through her mind. Mr. Carter replacing Mrs. Sorensen right before they left. Mr. Carter's nervousness on the trip up to the mountains, though he'd played it off as excitement about the retreat. Mr. Carter needing to go back to his room and call home more than anyone else did. Mr. Carter vetoing the idea of an unplanned final hike before they headed home that morning, insisting the schedule must be adhered to, that it would be an inconvenience to the families expecting them home at a certain time. Mr. Carter being pulled out of the RV and shot out of sight of Tessa and the others. Tessa knew she couldn't tell everyone what she'd learned. Mr. Jones would likely go ballistic, and the other kids? Well, you didn't tell kids that kind of thing, right? Maybe, if she got the chance, she could whisper it to Mrs. Wright, but she'd have to make sure no one else was around. Not an easy task in the pitch black of their cell. She turned her ear to the hatch again, but the voices were gone. Andrew Carter, real name Jeffrey Simmons, though no one called him that anymore, said,
"Sorry, guess I'm a little on edge.
and set the carton of bottled water on the ground next to the bag of apples Nyland had just put down. In an hour or so, they'd drop them through the hatch into the old doomsday shelter for the hostages' lunch.
"We're all on edge,"
Nyland said.
"But nobody else is whining like you. Grab a beer, calm the hell down."
He walked out of the dilapidated workshop that had been built over the shelter. Carter paused near the center of the room and looked down at the hatch. Three of the kids down there were worth a lot of money, but one of the others was worth something too. What and how much and why, he had no idea. He just knew what McGowan had told them.
"No matter what, nothing is to happen to the Herrera girl,"
McGowan had said, after they brought the hostages to this godforsaken place, where they would stay until the ransom was paid.
"And the job is not complete until we deliver her to the client, alive."
While this may have been meant to instill vigilance in everyone, Carter saw the information for what it really was, a way to safeguard his fee in the event things went bad. He smiled at the hatch and then went out to grab one of those beers. 29. Chinese Camp, California.
"It's Shinji," Rosario said.
She turned her computer toward the others and accepted his video request. The moment Shinji's tired-looking face appeared, Ricky leaned forward and waved.
"Shinji, buddy, how you doing?"
"Oh, hey, Ricky," Shinji said cautiously. "I'm okay, thanks."
There was a pause before he added, "How are you?"
"Couldn't be better, my friend. Me, Ananka, working together. It's a hell of a lot better than prison, I'll tell you that."
"I wouldn't know."
Ananka nudged Ricky away from the screen. "What's up?"
"Oh, do I have some stuff for you,"
Shinji said, his enthusiasm returning. He first told them about where the emails had been sent from and who had sent them. As he talked, he triggered a map to appear on Rosario's screen, showing the location of Tonopah. In two separate windows appeared images of the email sender and his vehicle.
"There is nothing else around this place," Rosario said, zooming out on the map so they could see the town was miles and miles from anywhere. "If we are operating under the assumption that the new deadline was triggered by the explosion,"
"which we are," Ananka said,
"and was sent 4 minutes after it went off,"
"and it was,"
"and that the kidnappers could not know exactly when that would happen,"
"I don't see how they could have,"
"then the sender had to have been waiting in Tonopah for a day or two at least, correct? I mean, if he were in a big city, he could be out and about and still find some place relatively quickly to email the deadline change. In this place, though, if he is not in town, he is out of luck. So
the children are either nearby, or the sender went there on purpose to wait until it was time to send a note,"
Liesl jumped in.
"Exactly."
Ananka nodded. The analysis was dead on.
"We need to get there, fast."
"Don't you want to hear what else I have for you?" Shinji said.
Everyone looked back at the chat box.
"What?"
Ananka asked. A video popped up and began to play. On the right side of the frame was a wooded area, and on the left, the start of a meadow. Horizontally bisecting the image in the lower third was a two-lane road.
"This is from a north-facing security camera attached to a Park Service building on Tioga Road, which is the eastern portion of Highway 120.
Highway 120 was the road that ran through Groveland, but on the west side, it was known as Big Oak Flat Road.
Here it comes," Shinji said.
Three cars passed through the frame eastbound and another two west.
"There."
A large RV the size of a touring bus entered from the left. It had a trailer attached to the back, the contents of which were covered by a gray tarp. As the vehicle went by, Ananka saw that the back end of the tarp was flapping in the wind. As it lunged upward, she caught the glimpse of two upright tires.
"Motorcycle tires?" she asked.
"Definitely," Dylan said. She frowned.
"I'm sure dozens of people haul motorcycles down that road every day."
"Possibly, but then there's this."
Another clip played. A new location, same RV, but this time as it passed center frame, an updraft caught the flapping end of the tarp and kept it raised for a few seconds. This provided a much clearer view of the back of the bikes,
and also revealed a third bike perched between them a bit farther forward in the trailer. Again, in and of itself, the clip was not proof that the RV had carried away the kids.
"I assume you have something more?" she said.
"Analysis confirms that the two visible tires are the same makes and models as those that made two of the tracks at the campsite you found. Also, that last clip gave my computer enough information to ID the bikes with a 92% certainty that they are also the makes and models of two of the bikes on the clip Ricky discovered. And don't forget, it's headed east toward Nevada, toward Tonopah."
Though still not conclusive, the connections could not be ignored. Ananka sat back. "It looks like we know where we're going next." Since driving would waste too much time, Shinji arranged for a Learjet to meet them at a private airfield outside East Oakdale, and soon they were on their way to Nevada. As they flew over the Sierra Nevada mountains, Ananka looked to the south for smoke but didn't spot anything. Had firefighters caught the fire in time, or was she not looking in the right place? "You alerted the authorities. There's nothing more you can do," Ananka told herself. "Any fire is not your fault." Maybe, but it sure felt like it. After they passed over the mountains and entered Nevada, the terrain rushing by below them became miles and miles of dry lake beds surrounded by barren rocky hills. When the pilot announced they were beginning their final approach, one thing was obvious. If there was such a place as the middle of nowhere, Tonopah was its capital. The community's dual runway airport was east of town. As they neared the ground, the pilot warned that their landing might be a little rough. And boy, was he right. The jet bounced all over the place as soon as it touched down. The reason became evident when they deplaned. The tarmac was in dire need of refinishing. A gray Ford Explorer and a dark blue Dodge Ram pickup that Shinji had also arranged were waiting for them.
"Pickup's mine," Ricky declared.
As long as Ananka didn't have to ride with him, that was fine by her.
Before leaving the airport, she touched base with Shinji to see if he'd come up with anything new.
"I have the RV turning toward Nevada on Highway 6, but after that, nothing. If they kept heading east, they would have had to change vehicles somewhere between the border and I-95. And if they didn't go that far, they're likely within 50 miles or so of Tonopah."
"What about our emailer?" Ananka asked.
"As of 10 minutes ago, his car was parked in the lot belonging to the Goodwin Hotel and Casino."
"Is that a fact?" 30. 50 minutes earlier. Office of the Administrator. A video chat request from Committee Member Tuesday popped onto the administrator's screen. The administrator accepted the call. "Mr. Tuesday, if you could just give me a moment, I'll give you my full attention." Tuesday did not look pleased.
"Make it fast."
The administrator put him on hold, and then, as he had been instructed to do if Tuesday requested any further one-on-one conversations, he covertly patched in Monday. After activating Tuesday's line again, the administrator said, "I apologize for the delay. How may I assist you?"
"I want an update on the kidnapping."
"We have an update for the full committee scheduled for this evening. Did you not receive your notification?"
"I am not about to wait that long. I brought this project to the committee. Progress reports need to be available to me whenever I ask for them."
"Sir, that's not how the committee works."
"This is a special case and you know it. Additional oversight seems prudent."
The administrator's gaze strayed to the monitor just left of the one Tuesday occupied, a change in focus that the committee member would not register as anything but a pause. In the second monitor, Monday nodded. "A valid point, Mr. Tuesday. Additional oversight would not be unreasonable." The administrator made a show of opening a folder on his desk that had nothing to do with the field team's mission. It was a prop to put the other man at ease. "The field team has traced a lead to," he paused as if searching for the information, "Tonopah, Nevada."
"Is that where the kids are? Have they found them?"
"The team is en route, but they are not sure if that's where the children were taken or not."
"Then why are they going there?"
"It's where the computer that sent the ransom notes is located." A startled pause.
"Really? What about the person who sent them? Do they know who it is?"
"They're working on that." It wasn't exactly a lie.
They didn't yet know the name of the man in the UNLV hoodie.
Tuesday grimaced.
What if it's a dead end? There's only, what, 17 hours left? Maybe we should just pay the ransom.
That is also not how the committee works.
I don't mean us, I mean the families. We should tell them to pay.
I'm sure you are aware that paying a ransom is no guarantee the hostages will be returned alive.
And if the field team doesn't get to them before the deadline, the kids will be dead for sure. At least this way there's a chance.
I'm confused, sir, the administrator said. If you think paying the ransom is the way to go, why did you bring this to the committee in the first place? Tuesday sighed.
My apologies. Children in harm's way is something that always gets to me. I don't actually think paying the ransom is the right thing. I'm just worried.
We all are. I suggest that if we get down to the last hour or two before the deadline and the team has not yet been successful, then we can recommend paying.
That sounds more than reasonable.
Is there anything else I can help you with? Tuesday shook his head.
Just keep me updated on any changes.
Of course. Tuesday reached forward and his image winked off. The administrator verified that the connection had truly been severed before he transferred his boss's feed to the center screen.
He clearly has no clue you've discovered his connection to the kidnapping,
Monday said. You've read my report then?
I have, and I'm not happy about it. This should have been uncovered during the vetting process.
It should have. And I take full responsibility. If you desire, I tender my resignation.
If I wanted you to resign, I wouldn't dance around it. What I want is for you to be extra vigilant in your search to find us two new committee members.
Yes, sir, the administrator said. Would you like me to deliver the news to Tuesday now? Monday took a moment before saying,
No. After the mission is resolved, he is in no frame of mind to listen at the moment anyway.
31. Tonopah, Nevada. They parked at opposite ends of the Goodwin Hotel's parking lot to allow more flexibility if they ended up having to get out of there in a hurry. To prevent drawing undue attention, Rosario, Liesl, and Ricky entered the hotel separately. Liesl and Ricky with instructions to search the lobby and restaurant area, while Rosario attempted a bit of techno magic at the reception desk. Ananka and Dylan would take the casino, but first they did a walk-by of the white Altima the target had been using. A few crumpled food bags sat on the passenger seat, but otherwise the interior was empty. Dylan nonchalantly tried the handle, but it was locked.
I could get it open in a snap if you're inclined.
Ananka shook her head. The longer they loitered around the car, the greater chance the target would walk out and see them. There was, however, one thing she did want to do before they left the vehicle. She retrieved her switchblade and tried to plunge it into the Altima's rear tire. Her angle was a bit off, so the blade caught on one of the steel belts, and she wasn't sure how much damage she'd done. She considered puncturing it again, but before she could do so, several people exited the hotel and walked in their general direction. The one cut would have to do. She and Dylan crossed to the casino entrance and went inside. Goodwin was no Caesar's Palace. The whole gaming operation took up no more space than a suite at the Wynn Hotel on the Vegas Strip. Even with the casino's smaller size, there were plenty of empty seats in front of slot machines and the three blackjack tables. Ananka motioned for Dylan to check left while she went right. As she walked past the beckoning machines, she scanned the gamblers. 90% were women, and of the 10% of men, all were older than the guy the team was looking for. When she reached the blackjack tables, she looked back toward Dylan. He shook his head. She gave the place another scan before rejoining him and heading into the hotel portion of the complex. Rosario was at the front desk, talking to one of the clerks, while Liesl stood near the restaurant entryway at the other end of the lobby. Ricky was nowhere in sight. Ananka nodded at Dylan to check the public hall that ran past the reception desk toward the back of the building. She then turned on her mic and whispered,
Liesl, anything? He is not in the restaurant. Where's Ricky?
Said he was going to check upstairs.
I never said anything about going upstairs. He said he had a hunch, I believe is the word he used.
Ananka shut her eyes for a second to temper her frustration. Yes, Ricky knew how to hunt, but
but at the moment they were supposed to be working as a group. They needed to coordinate their efforts to avoid getting in one another's way.
Ricky, come in.
A barely audible whisper came over the radio.
Can't talk. What's going on? Where are you?
He said something else, but this time she couldn't make it out.
Ricky?
Nothing. She tried again, but he didn't answer. Swearing under her breath, she looked back at Liesl.
Did he specifically say where this hunch was taking him?
He did not.
While Ananka could waste time looking for him, it would be smarter to stick to the plan. So when Rosario stepped away from the reception desk and headed toward the elevators, Ananka did the same. You and Dylan keep watch here in the lobby, Ananka told Liesl as she crossed the lobby, arriving at the elevators a moment before the doors opened. Conscious of the camera in the ceiling, Ananka and Rosario acted like they didn't know each other as they entered the car. Ananka then angled her head down to hide her face from the lens and whispered,
Did it work?
Rosario flashed the screen of her phone. On it was the list of guests she'd secretly downloaded while she was talking to the check-in clerk. She studied the screen and highlighted several names. The elevator dinged as they arrived on 4, the highest floor. Ananka exited first and looked around. Closed doors, used room service dishes on the floor, a typical hotel floor. The only noise was a hum coming from an ice machine just off the elevator lobby, a lobby, she noted, that did not have a security camera.
Did you find out the guy's room number? She asked as Rosario joined her.
There are 11 men staying alone. Give me 5 minutes. I could do some background checks and narrow things down.
We don't have time for that. I have a better idea.
Using Ananka's method, it only took them less than 6 minutes to check the fourth floor rooms occupied by single male guests. There had been no answers at 2, so they'd let themselves in and made sure no one was hiding inside. The other 3 were opened by men happily surprised to see 2 beautiful women at their door. None was their target, however, so Ananka and Rosario, acting as tipsy teases, apologized for getting the wrong room and stumbled off down the hallway. When they reached the third floor, they heard a dull thud from down the corridor. They shared a look and headed toward it. More thuds led them to a room halfway down the hall. Rosario glanced at the room number and then at her phone.
It's on my list.
Ananka put her ear against the door. She heard a thump and the expulsion of breath and then,
Just calm down, asshole.
Ricky. She picked the lock and shoved the door open. At the other end of the short entrance hall, in the space between the bed and the dresser, Ricky lay on top of the emailer. The struggle that had been going on stopped as both men looked to see who'd come in.
Hey, boss, Ricky said with a smile. I found him.
Rosario shut the door as Ananka strode into the room.
What the hell do you think you're doing? She asked.
Capturing the bad guy. Isn't that why we're here?
The emailer shoved at Ricky's chest, clearly realizing his bad situation had turned worse.
Hey, Ricky barked. Cool it. You ain't going.
Somehow the emailer's leg slipped free, allowing him to swing his knee hard into Ricky's groin. As air exploded out of Ricky's mouth, the guy flipped him toward Ananka and scrambled to his feet. In a flash, he opened the sliding glass door at the back of the room and disappeared onto the balcony. Ricky, eyes bulging, writhed on the floor at Ananka's feet, hindering her ability to get by him. When she did, she sprinted to the door and outside. The small patio was barely wide enough for the table and 2 chairs that occupied it, so the guy should have been right there, but he wasn't. She looked over the railing. To both her relief and disappointment, no broken body lay on the sidewalk below. She heard a pant and leaned a little farther out.
You little weasel, she said.
The target was hanging from a railing that ran underneath the patio. Before she could figure out a way to haul him back up, he swung once and dropped onto the balcony of the floor below.
Are you kidding me?
She clicked on her comm.
Liesl, Dylan, we found the target, but he's trying to get away. Watch all exits and don't let him get out.
There are only 2 of us down here, Dylan said. How are we supposed to watch?
Just do it.
Rosario, who had been backing her up in the doorway, moved to the side as Ananka ran back into the room.
He jumped?
Rosario asked, to the floor below. As they headed toward the door, Ananka glared at the still prone and cringing Ricky.
I swear to God, if we lose him.
She was out the door by then, so she didn't finish. Certain he hadn't stayed on the second floor for long, Ananka and Rosario skipped the elevator and flew down the stairs to ground level. Dylan was standing in the elevator lobby as they exited.
"He didn't come through here?" Ananka asked.
"Do you think I'd still be standing here if he had? What the hell happened?"
"Ricky happened," she growled.
Slowing their pace to not draw too much attention, the two women walked into the main lobby. Liesl was now across the room where she could watch both the restaurant and casino exits.
"No sign of him?" Ananka asked.